Even though we live longer, safer lives than our ancestors, it turns out Americans are more fearful and stressed out than ever. We're anxious about our health, crime, money, and a personalized laundry list of other scary stuff. But what do we do with all that fear? Our guest this hour says we can learn about it, use it, and sometimes get over it. I'm Veronica Rickert, in this week for Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Our guest today is Jamal Yogis. He's an award-winning journalist whose work has appeared in ESPN The Magazine and The Washington Post. His new book is called The Fear Project, What Our Most Primal Emotion Taught Me About Survival, Success, Surfing, and Love. And we want to hear from you this hour. What are you afraid of? What do you think it's possible to overcome in terms of fear? And what have you tried and succeeded with? You can call us at 1-800-642-1234. It's 1-800-642-1234, or you can send an email to talk@wpr.org. And Jamal Yogis, thanks for being here.
Thanks, Veronica.
Well, your book is called The Fear Project, and basically in this book, you tackle head-on the stuff you're really, really afraid of. What is it that got you started?
I think I always had an interest in fear. I was a shy kid, and my dad was in the service, and so we moved around, and you're constantly presented with that, being that new kid who sees those kids over there who he wants to play with, but also you want to be alone because you have that fear. And I would always make great friends over time. Someone would approach me and say, come play, and then I'd open up and be more gregarious eventually. And I was interested, I think, in how fear was lying to me. I never actually spelled it out for myself in that way, but that interest developed. And then I kind of turned it into a personality. I was like the mysterious, aloof guy in high school. It was like, that's how I got the girl. You know, I could be the artist or what have you. And that sort of worked sometimes, but once I got into the work world, you realize you need to sort of go after what you want. You have to be the aggressor sometimes, and you have to be brave. And so a public speaking tour for my first book that combined with a breakup, which was making me feel really insecure, and public speaking also making me insecure, fear was just front and center in my life, and I wanted to crack the case. I had this feeling just from picking up the newspaper every day that neuroscience and psychology were breaking boundaries in this field. You could crack open the brain now and look at what the heck's going on in there. So what did the sciences have to say, and how did that collide with, you know, these ancient traditions like yoga and meditation that my parents did that were clearly related to de-stressing and overcoming fear as well, but was there any connections between them? And so I just had a lot of big questions, and I felt I needed to crack the case for myself. But then, as you said in the introduction, I thought it was interesting that, you know, according to the United Nations, the whole world is living wealthier, healthier, longer, safer lives. The world is less violent than it was before, which is hard to believe when you watch the news, but and yet anxiety disorders are through the roof. You know, different types of mental illness and anxiety issues are up along with medication, and it's almost like the safer we get, the more we fear losing that safety. And with 40 million Americans suffering an anxiety disorder every year, I thought, well, maybe if I can help myself with this issue, it will also be helpful to others. So that's how it started.
So you just said in the middle of that answer that you discovered along the way that your fear was lying to you. What do you mean by that?
Well, fear is so often lying to us, right? We've all experienced it, especially in social situations. For me, I'm prone to social anxiety. Being at a new party where I don't know anyone is far more scary than jumping out of an airplane or something.
And you're not alone in that, yeah.
Right. And those fears are flatlying, because if you didn't feel them, you would just go up to the first person you saw and say hello, and it wouldn't be awkward at all because you weren't feeling the fear. So it's the fear is just in your mind, right? It's saying, if you talk to that cute girl at the bar, something bad will happen, you know. And that bad thing is never really that bad. And the reason evolutionary biologists will often tell you is that when we were wandering around the Serengeti, being ostracized from the tribe, that was a death sentence. You couldn't survive in the Serengeti alone. So now we live in this world where if you get ostracized from that group sitting around the bar that you just tried to talk to, nothing happens. You know, you just walk away, you go on living. But it feels to the lizard brain, this area where fear comes from, that's deep in the brain and doesn't necessarily listen to the logical parts of the brain, it feels as if it's still a death sentence sometimes. And it's why public speaking is so scary, and why so many of us are still hold on to this probably genetic trait of being outcast, so to speak. So fear is always lying to us in those situations. If you're wondering if you should heed the fear of not going and talking to that CEO who could give you a job at the party, and you want to, you know, it's selling you up the river. There are times when fear is not lying, clearly. I mean, when fear is telling me not to text while driving, while I have my one-year-old in the car, that's prudence, and it's a gift. But there are so many places where fear is lying, and this book really is about trying to distinguish between good fear and bad fear.
Well, you're talking about, you said that primitive part of the brain, the reptilian part of the brain, you're talking about the amygdala, right?
Yeah, that's where the scientists have really narrowed fear down to. I mean, there are other parts of the brain that do some fear learning, but this little almond-shaped gizmo deep in the limbic system, they call it, near the brain stem, seems to be the central hub. And even of that little almond-shaped thing, it's broken into 13 parts, and apparently just this one area is most associated with fear. But so they've been very specific. And the fascinating thing about this amygdala is that even in utero, it develops. It's one of the first things that develops in the brain. And the cortex that does all that human kind of thinking, the creativity and the logic and the future thinking, it develops much later and doesn't even really fully develop until we're teens. And in women, it develops before it does in men. The cortex does. So this amygdala is so central in our lives. I mean, this whole emotional system, and it is faster than logic. It's faster than conscious thinking. So by the time the murderer leaps out, you've already thrown your popcorn into the air before you can say, it's just a movie. And that's an amazing trait. And so fear is faster than you are. And what I've found is that you can't necessarily change that fear. It works on its own, but you can change how you react to it. And it's an understanding fear that you have that opportunity to say, okay, here's this lizard brain that's still functioning basically like it did 100 million years ago. And sometimes it's incredibly intuitive because it got humans this far, right? We're still alive, but it hasn't really updated its software to
right.
This modern world that's changed so rapidly.
Yeah, it seems like a holdover in some ways, because most of us aren't in danger most of the time of, you know, being eaten by a lion or something. Like, you know, you step out in front of a car and you see it and you jump back before you can think. Usually we're freaked out about maybe getting up on a podium to speak, you know, or something like that. And the response a lot of the time seems out of proportion. So in terms of that, what are the tools that we can work with to try to kind of mitigate that over the top fight or flight thing that we get from the amygdala?
Yeah, it's a good question. And, there are so many tools, and I try to cover a range in the book, but I've really come down in my own experience, and studies back this up too, that it's all about exposure therapy. Because, okay, you have this amygdala buried way down deep, and then you have these outer layers of the onion, the cortex, and they're kind of the slow lumbering professor, and the lizard's staying the lizard, and they're just not speaking the same language. So you can try to talk yourself out of fear to some extent, right? If you're, say, calm down, it's okay, you know, nobody's going to kill you. But if you notice before you get up on the podium, your heart doesn't really stop slow when you do that. And so they're not really speaking the same language. There are ways in cognitive behavioral therapy that you can sort of start to strengthen those communication pathways. But it's all about exposure. And what I mean by that is actually just going into your fears and facing them. And I was bit by a dog when I was in Mexico as a kid. And my fear response said, dogs are dangerous. So anytime I had a dog walking behind me, I would get nervous. And but I also said, you know, that town in Mexico also makes me queasy. And so fear, the amygdala makes these blanket statements and says, let's just, anything that we can associate with pain, let's fear it. And the right fear is to say, I will stay away from that particular dog that bit me. But most dogs that I meet are very friendly, and I know that. And so, and Mexico isn't necessarily dangerous. I love Mexico, but why do I get this queasy feeling? So the exposure therapy part comes in and saying, okay, the bad fear is this blanket statement about all dogs. So what am I going to do? I'm going to have to go and force myself to pet friendly dogs that are well-trained every day. And what you're basically doing is you're taking the modern part of your brain as being the adult, and it's taking the baby and it's guiding it by the hand and saying, look, dogs are okay. And it's the same thing we do with our children. My wife and I, our son was terrified of being abandoned in the crib, and he was so scared of being in the crib alone that we tried all these different techniques. And at one point, the baby whisperer, a British woman, said, you might have to get into the crib with your baby.
Wow.
This was sort of, it's really extreme.
That's a new one.
I slept in the crib with our son, Kaifas, for a night. It immediately changed his relationship to it, and then we started playing with toys in the crib and doing those sorts of things. And within a week, he was sleeping in his crib alone. And it was exposure therapy, but in baby steps. And baby steps is the key. I mean, if you're afraid of snakes, you don't want to go straight to holding a snake. You want to first look at pictures of a snake and maybe do some meditation before that. And then, you know, you work your way up to the big stuff, and you do that slowly.
Well, one of the bits of research that I thought was really cool in reading your book was that we used to think that, say you got, like your example of getting bitten by a dog, that that memory has a particular piece of real estate in your brain, and that every time you're in that situation, it just, your brain just kind of coughs it up, and you go right back into your panic mode about being bitten by a dog again. But it turns out that we're actually recreating those memories fresh every time, and that we can actually kind of rewrite them and interrupt them. Do I have that right?
You do, yeah. You summed up what was entirely befuddling to me for a long time until I wrote it in all these different ways trying to figure out what is a simple way to say this. But, yeah, it's exactly that. And so for the longest time, neuroscientists thought, yeah, the memory was there in a storage bank, and, you know, sort of like, I remember this episode of Muppet Babies where, like, Kermit the Frog was looking in a drawer in the brain, and, like, you could pull out that photo, and there it was. And it's not that, it is that way to some extent, but basically every time you're pulling out that photo of that first embarrassing kiss that you botched or something, that photo is actually more of a whiteboard, and you can do some erasing here and erasing there and redraw it. And what that means basically is that every time you remember that embarrassing kiss, you're tapping into the actual synaptic connections, and you're reconsolidating that memory, and it gets reconsolidated with whatever you're experiencing while remembering it. So if you're remembering it in this on vacation in Hawaii, you know, you're sipping a Mai Tai and laughing with your friends, it's reconsolidated with this new confident adult self where, oh, I have friends, I'm in Hawaii, life isn't so bad. And it turns out I'm a great kisser now. You know, whatever it is, then it, that memory does get changed and the emotion of it gets weakened.
So could you do that really deliberately, like, I don't know, like your dog biting example? Could you, every time you had that memory of getting bitten by that dog in Mexico, could you say, I'm not afraid of dogs, and I love dogs, and I've met friendly dogs, every time you're thinking it, and pretty soon the memory's gone?
Absolutely. I mean, that's when I have a nightmare about a shark let me give a better example, something pertinent to life. I have this recurring dream of being in a math class and not having studied.
Yeah, and it I think I've had that one too.
And it often comes when I'm behind in work. And I wake up feeling like a failure, like I really have failed. And so I have to go in and say, okay, there's that feeling, there's that worry, but how many times has that happened? Not very many. And actually conjure up memories of doing well, in, not just in math tests, but just in life, you know, moments that I've succeeded. And it takes a while because you're really, fear is gripping and your heart is clamped down, your gut's twisting, and there's all these physiologic reasons for that. And so it's not like you can just go, happy thought, oh, that was easy. it takes some creative power and sort of some visualization and saying, no, really feel that. Feel how, you know, your mom loves you unconditionally and you won that award for, you know, 3 years ago, and that was great. And it feels silly, like you're Jack Handy, you know, in Deep Thoughts or something, like, oh, people really like me too, but it works, you know, it works. And it doesn't work for everyone. I mean, positive thinking doesn't get the job done for some people who are really caught in a negative downward spiral, and the positive thinking almost reminds them how bad they are. They go, you know, you're like, oh, I'm really good, and that I'm really good is almost like, sounds cynical.
Or pathetic, or, yeah.
Yeah, like, I'm not even good at this positive thinking stuff. I really suck. And so it doesn't work for everybody, and if you're not that person, that's okay. There are other things you can do. For example, if you like athletics, I mean, doing something you feel confident in, like you could go for a run if that makes you feel great, and remember the experience there. Or so there are lots of ways sort of to skin this cat, but the trick, the basic message is we can use our thoughts to change our brain, and that's amazing. I mean, we actually have that power to do some restructuring, and we're learning more and more about that. You know, it's no mistake that there's a neuroscience book coming out every day saying this is amazing, because it is. It's amazing.
Well, in a bit, we're going to talk about some of the fears that you conquered, including swimming with sharks, which I still can't believe. And we're talking this hour about conquering our fears, about ways to understand what's going on in the brain when we're experiencing fear, and how to understand that anxiety, that fear, how to work with it, and how to overcome it sometimes as well. Our guest today is Jamal Yogis. He's an award-winning journalist whose work has appeared in ESPN the magazine and the Washington Post. He's got a new book out called The Fear Project, What Our Most Primal Emotion Taught Me About Survival, Success, Surfing, and Love. And we want to know, what is something that you are afraid of that you would love to get rid of? That fear. You never have to deal with it again. What is that? Maybe Jamal can give you some help this hour. And maybe you've had some things that you've tried on your own that have been successful. You can tell us about that as well. Call us at 1-800-642-1234. It's 1-800-642-1234. And you can also send us an email to talk@wpr.org. I'm Veronica Rickert, and I'm in this week for Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Veronica Rickert. I'm back with you this hour on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio as we learn how to conquer our fear with our guest Jamal Yogis. He has a new book out called The Fear Project, What Our Most Primal Emotion Taught Me About Survival, Success, Surfing, and Love. And before we go any farther, Jamal, you swam with great white sharks. That's crazy. I understand you're an ocean boy. You grew up in California. I'm terrified of sharks. I can't imagine getting into a cage with one. How did you do that?
Well, I wasn't in the cage with the shark. The shark was on the other side of the
okay,
cage.
Okay, well, that helps.
A clear distinction.
But even so,
It was spooky. I mean, when you see one of these animals are so big. And I compare them to an Airstream trailer with teeth, because they really are, I mean, like 8 feet wide, 6 feet deep, 18 feet long. And when you see one, you go, I really don't think I should get in the water. And you're remembering Richard Dreyfuss, you know, in the cage in Jaws, and how easily Jaws just sort of bent that thing and sent him to the bottom. But I was really interested in sharks because I surf out here in Northern California in the Red Triangle, and I have this fascination with them, and yet I also got nightmares about them all the time. And there was this dichotomy between, again, the lizard and the professor brain, and one saying, I'd like to study that animal, and the other saying, stay the heck away. And so I decided, let's try this exposure thing. And it turned out there is a boat that you can go out on and look for sharks, and they tell you to sign this paper saying you might die and not to sue them. But you have the opportunity, if you find one, you can't put blood in the water anymore and like fresh steak and stuff to lure the shark, but you get in the cage. And I was so amazed that it's a perfect metaphor, because when you're looking for the shark, you're down there in this cage and the water's just blank. There's no life out there except for an occasional seal, and they try to stay away because they know they're being hunted, and you just hear this and you can't help but play the Jaws music in your head, and then the shark finally comes, and the fear for me was not there. And this is most people's experience. You're just in awe of this animal, and you realize sharks, it's really true. They're not after humans. They're not man-eaters. That's why fewer than one person in the country dies from shark attack every year. It's one of the most irrational fears, really, because the sharks are just not out to get you. The most dangerous part about going swimming in the ocean is driving there, or if you're not a good swimmer, drowning. You know, 3,000 people die a year of drowning, but sharks, you know, it's the lowest on the list, and yet they occupy a huge fear for a lot of us. I mean, I argue because of storytelling, because we've been telling stories about these animals just because they look so scary for a long time, and maybe they did our ancestors more harm when we actually lived closer or even in the ocean. So there may be a biological fear, but at any rate, yeah, I got in the cage, and I am happy to report that I have not had a great white shark nightmare since seeing one in the flesh, in the scale.
Wow. Well, I might have to try that, except there aren't any great white shark expeditions out of Wisconsin, but which gives me a good excuse.
It makes a great date. I went out there with the woman I was courting at the time, who's now my wife, and we had a blast, and she was really terrified because she had this fear of deep water on top of sharks, and as soon as she didn't get in the cage, but she saw it from the boat, and she said right after, next time I want to get in the cage. It was such a beautiful animal. And so it really is, it's worth doing.
All right, I'll put it up there on the list of things maybe to do in 20, 30, 40, 50 years. All right, let's go to our callers now. Lauren on the line in Madison. Hi, Lauren.
Hi, how are you? Thanks for taking my call.
Good, thanks.
Oh, you want to know my fear?
Yeah.
I was laughing while you were talking about the sharks because you were giving statistics, and there are no statistics for my fear. I have a paralyzing fear of the movie The Exorcist, and have had it since the movie came out. I was about 12 years old.
And you saw the movie?
No, I never really did see the movie. I've seen clips of it, and I've heard it, not the whole movie, parts of it. And I think it's something I believe, at one time I believed could happen to me because I was raised in a Catholic household. My brother went to a Jesuit boarding high school and college, and they were the ones who would perform an exorcism, and I was very young when I heard all this. But it is still a paralyzing fear on Halloween, and there are advertisements for it on the radio. I'll freak out in my car, or if they show it on the TV for a a commercial saying the movie's coming on, I can't like even reach to change the channel on the remote.
Wow, so that's really something you've been dealing with for a long time. That's an interesting one. What do you think, Jamal?
That is interesting. I can't say that I have encountered this before. I didn't see the movie, and I think because it scared me too. So there are a few things. I mean, one, I think it's good that you're calling in and talking about it, because talking about these fears actually has been shown to help alleviate them, and talking about them in an environment, especially like with your family or somebody you trust and feel safe with. I mean, and especially sort of in a way where you could debunk it and say, well, I know it's just a movie, and that might get some traction, but it sounds like it's really deep, and it's so deep that it's causing you to freeze up. And I think it's interesting that freezing. We usually say fear is fight or flight, but it should actually be fight, flight, or freeze. And the reason some of us freeze probably has to do with this old instinct to play dead or camouflage when we were early mammals. That helped some of us, and it's clearly not helping now. It would be nice if you could get up and change the channel. So that's an interesting tidbit, and what helps freezing is moving, basically. If you can get up and, even do some jumping jacks or just resist that freezing, one of the neuroscientists in the book was always telling me, just moving lessens fear. And the other interesting fact is that when you have some amount of oxytocin, which we get from feeling love or feeling bonded with one another, that freezing doesn't take hold of the body. So a mother who has oxytocin in her system from giving birth can still feels fear, but she can move. She can defend her young from danger. So she doesn't get the freezing response. So a way to counteract that freezing, whether it's a movie like The Exorcist or something else that paralyzes you, is basically to have love in your life. I think that's interesting. And we don't need to necessarily fall in love. It can be just thinking of loved ones releases oxytocin in the brain. Really feeling that love, holding hands with someone, getting a hug, all these things that are sort of touchy-feely are actually love, and love in a chemical form, and love really is an antidote to fear. I don't feel like I'm expert enough. I mean, I should emphasize that I'm not a psychologist, and I'm a journalist who interviewed a bunch of psychologists, and so I don't have any particular sage advice in how to approach this. I think one brazen way to go would be to actually watch the movie, and say and do it in a way that maybe is with a bunch of friends, and sort of set up an exposure therapy experiment. But depending on how raw the fear is, it sounds like it's very intense. That might be too much. It might, require some kind of therapy before that, and sort of work your way up to it. But So, yeah, I don't want to give any diagnoses and medical advice here because I'm not a psychiatrist, but I think it's interesting, and thank you for calling in.
Some ideas to go off of there, and I love, you know, in reading your book, you talk about how a simple hug can sort of shoot off those oxytocin feelings in you, and it's a reminder that we can hug one another more and hug our family members more and maybe decrease anxiety along the way, and that's a pretty simple thing to do.
Absolutely. I mean, when you look at babies, I mean, the key feature in basically lowering their stress and making them feel safe is touch, just touching them. And babies who are denied touch grow up so stressed out that their brains don't form fully and they don't grow as much, because what fear and stress do is they shut down basically growth and immunity and digestion and all these things. So touch is so important and central to human development, and that continues through adulthood. It's not just babies who need touch. Don't be afraid to give someone a squeeze.
Well, good luck with that, Lauren. You work on Exorcist and I'll work on Sharks. We'll see how we do. And we'll go next to Jeff, who's calling from Dorchester, Iowa. Hi, Jeff.
Good morning. Great topic this morning. Gives me an opportunity perhaps to have a question answered that has puzzled me for as long as I can remember. I experience stress and anxiety and certain levels of fear, just like we all do on a regular basis. However, deep to the core, paralyzing fear, I never seem to experience that outside of a dream. Now, why is it that something that's in my subconscious like that can be exponentially so much more greater than it is in real life?
Interesting.
Yeah, it's a really good question. It's one I looked into to some extent. And basically, when you look at somebody who's dreaming in an fMRI, where you can see where the blood flow is in the brain, it's the amygdala and this limbic system, emotional early brain system, is hyperactive, and the cortex is not very active. And so dreams are just basically raw emotion. And it's why dreams can be sometimes really intuitive, where you have a dream where you're like, I think that person's lying to me or something, you know, and then it turns out to be true, and you go, oh, man, are all my dreams true? No, they're not. It's just that our emotional brain is very intuitive and can pick up on things that the conscious brain cannot. But it also makes these blanket silly statements like all dogs are dangerous. And when you look at there's a great book by Ernest Hartman at Tufts called Dreams and Nightmares, and he chronicles thousands of dreams and people who have endured trauma. And what he finds is a rape victim, for example, won't necessarily have nightmares about being raped, but they'll just have dreams of things that are traumatic, like a fire and a car accident, or so it's just like the raw emotion of raw fear is coming up in different ways, and the mind seems to be finding different symbols that are associated with that feeling of trauma and fear. And basically, what you're saying is, in your everyday life, you might have some low anxiety or stress, that sort of buzz, and it's probably because you're able to use your professor brain and say, well, I'm in control, basically. I might get a little emotional hit here, but I'm okay. And you have the ability to do that. In a dream, you don't have that ability. It's like it's tied. You're working with your just your baby brain. And so it's almost like you're going back to a kid and being a kid, and you don't have access to some of your adult information. And so that seems to be why dreams can be so much more scary than real life, and also sometimes so much more pleasant, where you have a dream about a place like Pandora in Avatar and you want to go back there. But because our lives are very stressful, these days, being busy, I think we tend to have more anxiety dreams.
Well, I hope that helps. Interesting answer to the question. It sounds kind of nice, actually, only having, you know, that super intense fear when you're dreaming. At least you can always wake up. But we'll talk more about fear and why it's happening, how we can cope with it, with our guest Jamal Yogis. He is an award-winning journalist who writes for The Washington Post, and his new book is called The Fear Project, What Our Most Primal Emotion Taught Me About Survival, Success, Surfing, and Love. And we're interested to hear about your fears. What are you afraid of, and what are you interested in overcoming? And maybe if you've got some techniques of your own that have worked, it'd be great to hear your story about how you overcame that fear. You can reach us at 1-800-642-1234. It's 1-800-642-1234. I'm Veronica Rickert, and I'm in for Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Veronica Rickert with you today on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Kathleen Dunn is out this week. And this hour, we're talking about fear and how to deal with it, understand it, and cope with it in our everyday lives. Our guest is Jamal Yogis, whose new book is called The Fear Project, where he really looks into the neuroscience of fear, at what's going on inside the brain, and goes on and tackles some of his most out there fears as well, including getting in a cage with a great white shark outside it, and also committing in a loving relationship. So these are things that are his particular fears, and we're hearing about yours this hour as well. And Jamal, before we went to break, we were talking about, you know, how, you know, it might be nice not to feel intense fear like our last caller did. But it turns out that fear actually is pretty useful. I mean, just real briefly, because we have a lot of callers waiting to talk to you. There was a woman that scientists found who did not have the amygdala, who did not have any fear. And at first, to me, it sounded incredibly cool. You could feel like a superhero. But she had some real problems with it, didn't she?
She did. I mean, the amazing thing was that she was able to raise a family. And so that alone just shows that we probably overfear, right? It's too prevalent in our lives. But the thing, she got herself into situations where she got attacked in a park, and then she walked through the same park at night alone again the next night. And she basically didn't have that good fear of prudence. And yet, you know, she wasn't driving off cliffs or, you know, putting her kids in the washing machine or something. So it wasn't so debilitating, but it did get her into trouble. And fear has a lot of great purposes too, in terms of just that subtle fear that you feel before going on stage or something. Fear is basically arousal, and if you can convert it into a positive where you say, okay, I'm feeling butterflies, but that means this is going to be fun, that means I care about this, studies have shown that it can actually be a performance enhancer. So getting into the zone in athletics and all that kind of thing, fear can be helpful with, provided it doesn't go into the freezing or panic state that just becomes irrational. So fear is good. It's just we sort of have to make friends with it and understand it to learn how to wield it in the right way.
Well, let's go to another caller now. Jane is joining us from Madison. Hi, Jane.
Hi, Veronica. Thank you so much for the show. It's really interesting. I wanted to share with you, so I love adrenaline things. I've been bungee jumping, and I've been skydiving, whitewater rafting, but I have a really intense fear of elevators.
Elevators.
I don't know. It's not, like, super common, but I've definitely met other people who are. And one of the things that helps me, or that I've, not necessarily that helps, but that I've noticed is relevant to what you were saying, is if I'm in a confident place in my life, for example, let's say I just got out of a job interview and the job interview went really well, you know, get me on that elevator. I'm on the top of the world and I can take it and the door's shut and it doesn't matter, because my main fear is that I'm going to get stuck in one and have to wait for someone to get me out. But if I'm having a bad day, I will climb 30 flights of stairs rather than get on the elevator. And
wow.
So it's interesting how, you know, related everything really is, and about how the fear really might not be a fear of the elevator at all, you know. So I was interested to what maybe you had to say about that.
Yeah, that's interesting, Jane, considering you do all of those other extreme sports like bungee jumping. And my producer, Rob, suggests that you think of riding in an elevator as being very slow bungee jumping. I don't know if that'll help or not, but what do you think, Jamal?
I love this example because one gets to the point that fears are connected at the root. And that's why I started this book, is because I'd been through this breakup and I knew intellectually I'd be fine, but I felt horrible. And it cast a shadow over everything I did. Like, I couldn't write. I loved to surf and I was surfing terribly. And I thought, this is unfair. I'm not actually afraid of these things. I'm afraid of, you know, that I might be alone romantically after this breakup, but I'm not afraid of these other things. And yet it's like when the amygdala gets stimulated, it becomes hyperactive and it starts putting its stamp on everything, and it makes life just uncomfortable and it seems unfair. And by contrast, confidence does the same thing. When you go out and, you know, when you've won that award or you catch that great wave, and then you walk into work with that pep in your step, and so I love that example of the elevator. You know, a lot of us have claustrophobia, and this could be an aspect of that, but the elevator, maybe there's a bad memory you could find of a time that was scary in an elevator, or it could just be something genetic. I was born with the fear of tiny little bumps close together, and I don't understand it, but it's there. And other people seem to have it too, but I think one thing that's interesting is that you do feel confident in the elevator sometimes, and to rely on those memories to emphasize them. One thing I discuss in the book is negativity bias, how the brain is wired to emphasize the negative and the dangers, because if it didn't, you might forget that threatening thing that happened to you and walk right into that trap again, right? So the brain is like Velcro for positive experiences, or negative experiences, and Teflon for positive ones, as one neuroscientist put it to me. So you're wired to remember those negative experiences in the elevator and say, and sort of magnify them. So consciously remembering the times when you did walk out of that interview and say, and felt great in that elevator, and remembering them repeatedly, actually sort of, it turbocharges them and it makes them more vivid. And the brain, I mean, your brain, every memory has real estate, so you strengthen those memories and the negative ones become less powerful. And the most important thing is that when those negative fears do come up, that you know are irrational, it's when they're triggered that you want to remember the times you felt positive in the elevator, when you felt confident. Because if you wait too long, if you wait till you're feeling just positive to remember the bad one, it doesn't contact the fear. It just sort of creates a new memory, but you want to get to the fear memory, if that makes sense. So there's a few things that off the top of my head.
And maybe this is, you know, what you were getting at. There is some exposure therapy would be good for Jane. Maybe she rides up a floor at a time while she's hugging her favorite person and eating a cupcake or something.
I like it. Yeah, maybe go. I'm seeing a tour of, like, the elevator's best elevators of the world, the glass elevator, you know, elevator at the Eiffel Tower.
Right, yeah.
Yeah, especially because you have this thrill-seeking personality, which I do too. It's psychologists call us high sensation-seeking personalities. And one thing I'll say too is to do one of those things that makes you feel confident and gives you a little high, and then go in the elevator. Because for me, public speaking is scary, and what I've been doing on this book tour is these publicity stunts where I'll swim through a freezing cold river to get to the bookstore or something. And I'm always a little nervous about that, but when I get out of the river and get into the store, it's almost like, one, I'm riding the confidence of having completed the task, and then also I've exercised, which is a stress release, and I'm feeling more calm. And it's uncanny how well it works.
Right, and exercise is almost like this magical elixir about anxiety and stress and by association, fear, isn't it? It just sort of makes you more able to cope with fear than people who aren't. There are some experiments with rats that you cite where the rats who are able to run on the wheel are much more able to cope with stress than rats who don't.
Yeah, I mean, fascinating. These rats that can run on the just do a little jogging every day, they will explore a labyrinth more fearlessly than the sedentary rats who will just hide in a corner. And exercise is fascinating because it's actually a stressor on the body, stimulates the sympathetic nervous system, but then it becomes a stress release at the end. And it makes a funny kind of sense to me in that in the wild, fear would have been motivating us to action. If you're afraid you're going to run out of food, you get the adrenaline, you run out energy to run over the mountain, or you see the bear, you need to run away. So fear is basically telling the body, go and move. And if you're just sitting at your desk accumulating fear and stress and doing nothing about it, it doesn't have an outlet. And so we have to give our fears and stresses the outlet their body is expecting, which is to go run or swim or do some jumping jacks or yoga. And it works amazingly well, and rats, I mean, there's so many interesting studies. Rats also that can't exercise, but they can have the opportunity to beat up another rat to get out their stress, they will do that. And that's a G-stressor, too. So when you put
maybe
that,
not the best option for
right,
most of us.
And you look at humans and you think, yeah, there's a lot of people getting their stress out that way.
Yeah.
Be nice to get them on the treadmill.
All right. Well, I think we have time for one more quick call. So let's take Chuck in Lake Delton. Hi, Chuck.
Hi. How are you?
Good. How are you?
Say, the letters F-E-A-R stand for false expectations appear real.
Hmm. Right.
I've heard this before. I heard another person say it was false evidence appearing real. And I like it because one, it points to the fact that fear is in the mind. It arises in the mind. It ceases in the mind. There are, of course, those times when fear needs to be heeded. And it's a time when this acronym doesn't work. But I think for the majority of us who could stand to push ourselves into our fears a bit more, it's a great reminder. False evidence appearing real, is that what it was?
False expectations appear real.
Oh, false expectations. That's interesting. I mean, there is this idea in Buddhism. The Buddha said all fear comes from desire, because if you get rid of desire, what do you have to fear? And that might be a little bit difficult for the majority of as to do, just toss out desire, not even advisable in terms of your career. There is some amount of truth to it where, you know, you look at Norway has been studied, and they say Norwegians are one of the happiest countries on earth because they have low expectations. They just think things are going to be rather drab and rainy and cold or something. And so they're continually surprised by the fact that they're just alive. And
so wait, the Norwegians are the happiest because they're pessimists?
Not necessarily pessimists, but just, you know, they're not expecting much from the future. They're just expecting life to sort of to go. And maybe realists, you could say. It is interesting. I mean, in this day and age, we have a huge amount of anxiety in our young people right now. And we've all been told that we can be anything we want to be. And which I think is wonderful, and and true to some extent, but it's also a lot of pressure, right?
Like, and we've got about 10 seconds left, Jamal.
You can do a lot. So anyway, it's complicated, but thank you for the acronym. I think it's helpful.
All right. Well, thank you for that call. And Jamal Yogis, thank you to you for coming on and sharing what you've learned with us and your own experiences. Great to have you on.
Thank you, Veronica. It was a lot of fun.
Jamal Yogis, our guest. He's an award-winning journalist whose work has appeared in ESPN The Magazine and The Washington Post. And his new book is called The Fear Project. Thanks to Amanda Magnus for producing this hour and Rob Ferret for taking your calls. I'm Veronica Rickert on the Ideas Network.